Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Trisha's True Crime Radio, where we are a sparkling lemon flavor tonight. Thank you for joining me. We have a great show in store for you. First off, I got to mention a couple of things, okay? One of the great things, the Doris Day Animal Foundation. This is a national nonprofit foundation founded by the actress Doris Day, and she was noticing even in Beverly Hills there were unwanted dogs on the street that were being put to death or killed by cars, and she was devastated by this. So Doris Day did something about it. She formed the Doris Day Animal Foundation, which is working hard today as we speak. Check out their website, DorisDayAnimalFoundation.org. They live by donations. Just do keep that in mind, and it is tax-free. Okay, legal goo time. Opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests. Trisha's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from WebSleuths.com, LLC, and ForumsForJustice.org. A couple of updates for you. Michael in Minnesota, my co-host, he is doing fantastic. Now, a little over a month ago, he lost everything in a devastating fire. I mean, everything was just ashes. And he also lost his pets. I mean, they were his babies. I think one cat survived and the dogs and the other cat gone. It was so tragic. I was very worried about him. He was very upset and understandably so. Well, he went down and he rescued another dog. I talked about that. He's changed her name. Her name is now Jess. And he said Jess just fits her better. And he has a new house. It's on 5 acres. It's a horse acreage, basically. It's a nice house, lots of room for animals to run around. So Michael went down, or actually called up one of the local shelters, one of the local rescue missions, I should say, and said, let me foster some dogs. Let me foster the most unruly, the most difficult dogs you have, because I can get them well enough to be adopted. And that's the kind of guy Michael is. He's always looking out for the animals and for the two-legged kind like us. He is a wonderful man with a big, big heart. And did you hear the news? Alice from the Brady Bunch has gone to that big Hollywood set, Kitchen in the Sky. Yes, Anne B. Davis, she was 88 years old, in great health. But here's what happened. This morning, in her home in San Antonio, Texas, she slipped in the bathroom. She hit her head so hard that it caused a deadly brain injury. She didn't recover, didn't wake up. And that's, I don't know, it just seems like a passing of an era. Alice was always there with that goofy smile, and the Brady Bunch was so phony anyway that you just have to love it. We could only hope for a family that was half as happy as the Brady Bunch. Wouldn't it be ironic if Anne B. Davis was cleaning the bathroom? I think that would just be terrible. Anyway, Anne B. Davis, sorry to see her go. She was really a true, she was a true Christian. She lived with a Christian community and did a lot of work for people who needed help. And so she will be missed because, after all, it was Alice from the Brady Bunch. Okay, we are going to get to our show. This guy, oh, wait, one more thing. I want to tell you about Anna. Randy Sutton will get to you in just a second. There is this wonderful woman. Her name is Anna. I met her last summer. She is a one-woman train just barreling through trying to find information about missing baby Melissa McGuinn. Now, here's the deal. Baby Melissa was only 7 months old when she disappeared in New Jersey in 1989. She was just a baby. A woman who was mentally challenged that was living with Melissa's parents took her for a walk and then came back and said somebody stole the baby. It was just a horrible thing. And she has never been found. Now, there's a river close by the house. However, the timeline of when the baby was reported missing and when she was taken from the house, there wasn't enough time to get to the river. So there is speculation, and it is widely believed that somewhere baby Melissa is still alive. And Anna is going to go down to New Jersey this week and talk to the detective. So she would like your help. She would like your input. There's a Facebook page set up. It's called Find Baby Melissa. That's at facebook.com/findbabymelissa. And you can also go to websleuths.com and just check out our Missing But Not Forgotten forum. Click on the 1980s, and Baby Melissa's story is there. Or you can Google her. That's Melissa, M-E-L-L-I-S-A, McGuinn, excuse me, M-C-G-U-I-N-N. I said two L's, didn't I? It's one L. MelissaMcGuinn. Google that, and the whole story will come up. And Anne, good luck to you. Anna, we are with you. We're going to talk to her next week on my show. So she'll give us all the update. Okay. Now we're going to talk to the man, the legend, and I'm telling you, this man is a legend. He has, as a decorated retired police officer, he was also a detective, and he's been in movies, and if you ever watched Cops and they were in Vegas, he was on it. I think he was on like 10 million episodes of Cops. He is everywhere, and he is starting a new challenge for everybody. We're going to talk about that, but please welcome to Trisha's True Crime Radio, Randy Sutton. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing great. It's nice to be here. Thank you.
Good. Well, I'm glad to talk to you. I mean, you've done an awful lot. Why don't you give us a little bit about your biography, where you started, how you kind of, your career kind of careened into acting, and tell us how that all came about. Tell us when you were a baby, when you started at the police force.
Well, I was almost a baby when I started. I was when you were mentioning New Jersey, I actually started my career as a Princeton, New Jersey police officer in the 70s. I was 19 years old and I became a cop, and if that doesn't frighten me, it should. They had just changed the age of majority from 21 to 18, and I got hired through a weird set of circumstances. So I went to the New Jersey State Police Academy. Now, you could do everything when they change the age of majority for a very brief period of time. You could vote, you could drink, and you could become a cop.
Wow.
One thing you couldn't do, though, was you couldn't buy ammunition because the federal firearm statutes required you to be 21. So on the first day of the police academy, I'm ready to go to the academy, and I don't have any bullets, so I can't buy any. So my mom had to go to the gun shop with me and buy my bullets for the police academy.
I bet you got teased about that.
Oh, my gosh,
that's too funny. You were just a baby. You were a baby, weren't you? You really were. Your mama.
I really was a baby. Mama had to help. Yes, I was.
Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry. Continue.
So I started my career as a cop in Princeton, New Jersey. I spent 10 years there. When I was a detective, it's a small town, though, you know, where Princeton University is, and there's a lot of, it's a small community with my hometown. And to tell you the truth, I was kind of bored as a small town police officer. Mm-hmm. So I made the decision. I had 10 years on. I was actually, believe it or not, almost halfway to retirement at the ripe old age of 30, and made the decision that I needed to move elsewhere. So I researched different departments, and I tested for Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, which at that time, We had a community of about 500,000. It's now almost 2.5 million. And I went and I tested and got hired as a Las Vegas Metro cop. And
you know
the old adage, be careful what you wish for.
Oh yeah.
You just might get it. Well, that's what happened in Las Vegas. I wanted more action, and believe me, I sure did get it.
Oh, so I can imagine Las Vegas.
Oh, it was, you know what, though, when I look back, I made all the right decisions when it came to that, you know, that part of my career. So I spent 24 years with Metro, and of course, in between that time, I've also written 3 books. I have a 4th one coming out at the end of this year, and we can talk about that in a little bit.
Absolutely.
I appeared, as you said, I was in, it wasn't quite a million episodes of Cops, but was about 14. And that was a very interesting time in my career because,
go ahead. I don't want to interrupt you. What were you going to say?
No. Feel free.
No, I see you said believe it or not, and I want you to finish that because it sounds interesting.
Well, my first foray into the cops world was when the first year that they were on the air in 1989. And I went on the air as a patrol officer, and then in the subsequent years was a sergeant. And so I wound up in, I'm going to guess, about 14 episodes that they aired. There were several more they didn't. for political reasons, but there was.
Oh no, that sounds
story.
Juicy. That sounds way
yes,
juicy. Let's
is.
Talk
yeah,
about cops for a minute, and we'll get into the juicy part here because that's what we do here. We want the juice. We're talking with Randy L. Sutton, former Las Vegas police sergeant. Did you say you were a sergeant? You ended up as a
lieutenant.
Sergeant, lieutenant.
Lieutenant. Right.
Lieutenant. Okay. Former Las Vegas police lieutenant, and we're going to go through his career here because he has a lot of irons in the fire, but he was on cops a lot. If you saw cops in Vegas, I promise you, Randy Sutton was on it. A lot of people want to know, me included, how do they do that? And do you know, two questions. How do they film it? Kind of give us a rundown of how they film it. And two, aren't you aware the cameras are on you, so don't cops act differently or not?
That's a great question. Because one of the factors when they make a decision about if you're going to be on that television show, they first thing they do is they send a producer out with you with a handheld cam to see if you're going to act up for the camera.
Mm-hmm.
And that really, I mean, that truly is a factor. So if you change your methodology in order to act up for the camera, they don't want you.
Mm-hmm.
They want to make sure
okay.
that you're going to be natural, you're going to do what you do, and they just want to capture it. That is true reality television, and it was actually, they were the first true reality television show.
Mm-hmm. They were, absolutely.
So they,
and keep going.
So they give you that kind of screen test, if you will, to make sure that you don't act up and you don't act towards the camera.
Mm-hmm.
And then they see if you can get into the stuff, so to speak. I'll clean mm-hmm. it up a little bit for your show. But
This show, Randy, this show is totally filthy, so feel free. I mean, just let loose.
Okay, very
That's
good.
What we do here.
If you're what they call a shit magnet in police work, then they want you because that is where that's their meat and potatoes. If you can get into it, that's what they want to see. And the first night that the producer met me, and what they do is they go to the department, they get permission from the department to film, and then they go to the supervisor and say, well, who's going to be your shit magnet?
Mm-hmm.
And I was the shit magnet. So they threw a producer with me. And the first night, we got into some pretty hairy stuff, and we actually hit it off really well. And he mm-hmm. watched me do my thing, and that was it. They decided to ride with me. They rode with me and got a number of really good episodes, which are still available on They're still showing. I mean, they're still making money on me, which is amazing to me.
And that's the other thing. Do you get paid?
No. No.
Nobody,
the department sometimes get they may get a donation of some equipment or something, but the officers who are featured on that show get nothing for it. Nothing.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking with the former lieutenant Randy Sutton with the Las Vegas Police Department, and lieutenant. Excuse me, I'm going to turn my phone off. You're not lieutenant anymore, but I'll just give you that title anyway, just because it sounds good and it fits. You were on.
So you can call me lieutenant.
I'll keep calling you that. We've all seen Cops, and we love the show. Do they edit it to make it more intense than it really is? I mean, a lot of stuff has got to be edited out, right?
They edit a lot of it, but because there's so much, you got to keep in mind that say they rode with me for 3 weeks in a row, they were mm-hmm. lucky to get three or four episodes from that because, you know, much of what police do just simply is not worth the story. So,
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of mundanity in policing. There's a lot of stuff that is not worth filming. And then there's stuff that they don't want to air simply because it is something that the public would not find either interesting or the department. Now, keep in mind that every police department's chief looks at the footage that they're going to show and has to approve it before they put it on the air.
So, oh, okay. You know, so it does go through the cops. So they have a hand in it in letting it. Okay, that's interesting to know. Okay, please continue. So that they get to look at it and decide if they can air it, right?
Right. And there's you know, unfortunately, politics enters into everything. Probably got double the amount of episodes with me in it that they tried to air, but at the time that the second and third season that I was on, during that time period, I was not in favor with the sheriff. And
oh dear, okay.
So, and the producer actually told me when they because they got a lot of great stories with me, but the sheriff was he told him this, quote, "This is not the goddamn Randy Sutton show," and would not allow them to air a number of the episodes that they got with me.
Oh,
simply
no.
Because I was on his political enemies list. So that takes
and
place
so
also.
It had nothing to do with the content. It was just because he had a bullseye for you, and he was not going to let you turn it into your show. I'll say, okay, please continue.
So that was from being on that television show, though. I was contacted by a casting agent, and they were filming according to this casting agent, we're filming a movie here in Vegas, and the director wants realism because there's a part for a police officer, and they saw you on Cops, and would you come in and do an audition? No idea what the movie was, but I had done some acting before at community theater in Princeton, but clearly I was okay in front of the camera, so I said, sure, I'll come down there. And I walked into this audition room, and I who's standing there but Martin Scorsese and Robert De Niro.
And oh, did you about have a heart attack?
Yeah, I pretty much did, yeah.
Yeah.
And they were filming the movie Casino. Mm-hmm. So my audition actually consisted of, tell us some stories about your career. And after about an hour, we were all laughing our ass off. and they said, okay, you got the part. That's it. And when it actually came down to do the scenes that I was in, it was actually a pretty good speaking role. Robert De Niro and I actually ad-libbed the scene. The lines that were written were not used because we just played with it a little bit. And so I got to do an ad-lib scene
with Robert De Niro.
In the movie, it's towards the end of the movie Casino, and Sharon Stone is smashing her car into Robert De Niro's car in the driveway of their house.
Right.
And
right.
I was one of the cops named Randy. Boy, that was a tough role. I was a cop named Randy, and I was the guy that responded to the domestic.
I remember that. Absolutely, I do. I mean, do you know how many actors would give their right arm to work with Robert De Niro? Oh, my God.
It was amazing. It truly was. And Robert De Niro is a gentleman. Everybody on that set was wonderful, with the exception of Sharon Stone. And
I was just going to say, you got to fill us in on that, because everybody knows she's difficult. And this is all about the dirt here. So let's hear it. Why was she the one that wasn't the best to work with?
Well, you know, at first everything was okay. And I was in a couple different scenes there. And one of the scenes, which was really, truly a mundane scene, it was very simply, I was this movie was a period piece. So it was taking place in the,
sure,
in the early 70s. And as such, they had to go out and find an old Ford Torino and paint it up like a police car. So they must have searched some type of auto graveyard, and they found this old beat-up Ford Torino and painted it up to look like an old Las Vegas police car. The problem with it is that it had a top speed of about 20 miles an hour. So when we hit the scene, I was supposed to be following Sharon Stone in her Mercedes. And every time mm-hmm. they did the scene, her car went faster than mine. But I was supposed to be right on her bumper. And I couldn't do it because the car just didn't go fast enough. So, I mean, this is very mundane stuff, but they were getting pissed off at me because I wasn't keeping up with her. And they would have to shoot the scene over and over and over again, and the directors, Scorsese is getting pissed at me because I couldn't keep up with her. And I kept on saying, well, and first I was diplomatic. Her car is faster than mine. She just needs to, get off the gas and just let me follow her. So they kept on doing the scene, and they kept on getting more and more pissed off at me. And every time that they would do the scene over again, they have to set it up. They have to stop traffic. I mean, it's expensive to do this stuff. And
it's a pain.
And it's a pain. And she would be giving me driving tips every single time, like it was my fault. So she'd be,
oh my God,
her car would be next to mine, and she'd be saying, now, if you step on the gas the same time I do, and I kept on saying to her, it's your car. Your car is faster than my car. And finally, we shoot this scene like 12 times, and everybody's pissed off. And she said, and she looks at me, and she says, and another thing, if you put your hands at the 10 and the 2, and
two.
I lost it. I said, are you Miss Freaking Motor Trend? And she lost her mind.
What did she do?
She wanted to be fired immediately.
Oh,
she demanded
I love
that
it.
She demanded that they remove me from the set.
And did they?
They had to stop shooting for the day just to stroke her a little bit. Because all of my scenes were done. They would have had to reshoot the entire freaking movie. So.
Oh, my God.
They eventually calmed her down.
I love that.
And we did the scene, and she slowed her car down, and this little shitty scene that we were in finally got done, and it turned out to be an Academy Award winner for her.
Oh, and the thing is, there's stories about Sharon Stone all over the place like that, so it's not surprising to hear that, but what I don't get is go ahead.
What's very funny is that I wound up to be a hero on the set because she had this, the crew really didn't like her because of her attitude towards them. So when they heard what happened, they came up to me, and I was treated like a god because I simply said those things to her. It was very funny.
Well, it's because you didn't have anything to lose, and if an actor said it to her, they may never work again, So good for you for standing up for yourself to Sharon Stone. We're joined by Randy Sutton. He is a former police lieutenant with the Las Vegas Police Department, and he's done a million other things, including acting jobs, like we were just talking about. He had a part in Casino, and we do have a question from our chat room. What was your character in Miss Congeniality, and did you have any scenes with Sandra Bullock?
Yes, I did, as a matter of fact. I did several movie roles after Casino, including Miss Congeniality 2. I also did a scene with Salma Hayek in a movie, where I played I delivered her baby on the bridge, which is a whole other story. But with Sandra Bullock, talk about a lovely, nice woman who is incredibly talented. I did a scene with her where I played a pit boss in the casino. It was a very small part, very small speaking role. But I got to watch her. I got to meet her. And talk about a hard-working, down-to-earth actress, incredible actress, and
really?
and a good human being.
That's good
being.
To hear.
She was just she was a pleasure to be with, and I have nothing but fond memories of that little tiny part.
And that was Miss Congeniality 2, Armed and Fabulous, I think
right.
is what it was called.
Exactly.
Right,
exactly. That's the one. Yes.
And, mm-hmm. Well, now we have to get into this dirt here. And I know this is supposed to be a true crime show, but basically I use the true crime as a cover because I just want to get down to gossip. So here we go. You had to, your character, you had to deliver a baby of Salma Hayek's on a bridge. What movie was that? And what, you said that's a whole other story, so tell us.
Oh, that was the part that I played was a Boulder Dam police officer who delivers her baby on the bridge at the Boulder Dam, and
mm-hmm.
so I can honestly say that I was between Salma Hayek's legs for 3 days.
Oh, you are the envy of so many men listening now. What movie was that?
It was called Fools Rush In with Matthew Perry.
Fools Rush In, that's right.
Right, and a very fun
and how
movie.
Was,
to,
well, how was she
okay.
to work with? I love her.
I didn't really have that much, even though I truly was within that close proximity to her. The first day she said pretty much nothing to me. The second day, mm-hmm. about halfway through the shoot, she looks up at me and she says, "So, are you from L.A.?" And I said, "No, I'm from Vegas." And she goes, "Oh." You know, like it was,
that was
you,
it.
Unless you're an actor from Los Angeles, you can't be an actor. And so
yeah,
that was
right.
the
can't
extent of our
get
conversation.
About you.
Yeah, but it was still a fun experience. There was an interesting incident on the set on that movie.
Mm-hmm.
The scene that we did was, like I said, we were delivering her baby on the bridge, and it was during a torrential rain. Well, the way that they set that up is there is a long iron pipe on a crane that they flow the water through so that it looks like it's rain. Mm-hmm. And
okay.
the pipe probably is 100 feet long. I'm going to guess it weighs 700-800 pounds. And while the scene is going on, the chain that held the pipe broke. And the 700-pound pipe falls to the ground and lands between everybody and by some, literally, miracle, doesn't hit anyone. Because it would have been a fatality. So
immediately,
it down
oh
like
my
two
god!
Feet from me, I almost had a freaking heart attack. And
yeah,
and,
I bet.
That was the. So they had to redo this whole scene, but it was pretty hairy. But that was
that would
that
be
was
very
another
scary.
Fun movie to do, and then let's see, I did. Then I acted with James Caan. I actually co-starred in the premiere episode
That's right.
of. Las Vegas. With
now,
James
how
Con.
Was that? How was
know,
that? Now, let me just tell you real quick.
Bad guy.
Oh, good. Good. What was
yeah,
the bad
that
guy?
That was nice, finally. I got to play a degenerate
yeah.
gambler cheat that James Caan arrested.
Very good. And so you had a big speaking part in that first episode, right?
Yes. It was a very good part. Uh-huh.
Good. And James Caan's, I think, a nice guy. My ex-husband actually did some plumbing for him. Didn't have any idea who he was. I just happened to see a check from James Caan. I went, oh, why is James Caan giving you money? He goes, oh, I replaced his water heater. Who is he? He was so clueless. You know, I'm like a drooling groupie about ready to die because I want to meet him, and he didn't even know who the hell he was. But, yeah, he seems like a really nice guy.
Well,
was he pretty nice to work with or not?
You've been fooled then because he's really not.
Oh, really? Oh, well, that's too bad. There goes my marriage plans. What the hell? Too bad. Too bad. So do you have any more movies in the future, any more TV shows coming up? Or?
I do. Yep, I do, as a matter of fact. I begin filming. Actually, it's related to, you know, it's very interesting the way life works.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my present life is now that I'm a full-time writer. And my new book is about to be, hopefully it'll be out around Christmas time of this year. It's called The Power of Legacy, Personal Heroes of America's Most Inspiring People. And one of the things, you know, after after I retired, and I'll tell you the reasons for my retirement, because it really plays deeply into what the future holds. But
Randy, can you hold on one?
Yes.
Randy, can you hold on one
sure.
second? I just want to remind people we are going to talk about the shooting in Santa Barbara with Elliot Rogers, and Randy is going to weigh in and give us the reasons why the cops didn't enter the house. We are going to get to that, so don't worry, but I want to hear this. Okay, so please continue. Didn't mean to interrupt. I just wanted to make sure people knew they didn't miss it yet. We're still going to talk about it. Okay, continue.
And, you know, we can
more.
Talk about that now and go back to this if you'd like, because
this is
stuff.
Let's do that, and that way we can leave the fun stuff for the end, because that way we can end it on an up note rather than a bummer note talking about this terrible shooting.
Right.
So just remember what you were talking about, because I will forget by then. My memory is toast. It's gone. It's, you know, all I can say is lots of drugs in the 70s will do that to you. Okay. So I guess I shouldn't tell that to an ex-cop, huh? Anyway, I'm kidding.
I'm a child of the 70s too. Don't worry.
Okay, so you know. Okay, good. This was such a tragedy, and I'm sure you've seen the video of this, Elliot Roger. He was the son of the assistant director of the Hunger Games. The video, it's either chilling or almost, like, comical, like he was trying to be. Some people think it looks comical, like he was trying to be as scary as possible, and other people think it was chilling. It was just tragic is what it was. But now here's the frustrating thing, Randy, and Randy is a former lieutenant with the Las Vegas Police Department, also worked in New Jersey as a cop. Randy knows his stuff. A lot of people are criticizing the police because the parents knew there was something wrong with him. And so they went over to the apartment to check on him. They didn't go inside. They didn't do anything except just talk to him. And people are frustrated. Why didn't they go in? Why didn't they do something? This guy was saying crazy stuff. He was just weird. His parents knew he was going to explode. And yet nothing was done. And the cops have been getting a lot of grief for that. And Randy, explain. Tell us how that all went down and what the cops could and could not do.
You know, this is every police officer's nightmare, to respond to a call. And when you evaluate it, understand that you have your gut feeling about something, but you're also constrained by this little document called the Constitution of the United States. And,
right.
You know, here's the long and short of it. The officers were responding to a call. It's called Check the Welfare. A Check the Welfare call is a very, has a lot of different, it can go in a lot of different directions. Really what it comes down to is someone who knows an individual is concerned about their welfare. They haven't heard from them in a while. They've been depressed.
Mm-hmm.
They have made threats to themselves in the past. And so relatives or friends from a law or coworkers from a distance say, you know, I'm concerned about them. Would you please go over and check and see if they're okay? And that's what a check the welfare call is, and that is exactly what the officers were dispatched to do. So they go to this individual's house. The mother had been the caller, hadn't heard from her son, was concerned. And when the officers got there, the suspect, who is, you know, this Elliot moron, answers the door.
Right.
And they check to make sure he's okay. He answers their questions. He says, I just haven't had time. You know, I'm okay, et cetera, and so forth. And the officers don't go into the apartment. Well, the reason the cops don't go into the apartment is because they have no lawful reason to go into the apartment. They don't know all of the stuff that comes out later on, of course. They're just there on a very simple a few lines on a computer screen, basically,
mm-hmm.
which is, check the welfare of this guy, Elliot. And if they had gone into his apartment, this is, now, what, there's two perspectives. In the information that came out after this incident took place and he killed all those people, he, in his deranged manifesto, said that if cops had come in, they would have discovered his arsenal and his plan.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, that gives fodder to, you know, the people that want to find blame here. And
mm-hmm.
They want to put the blame on the officers for not going
yes.
in and finding the firearms and finding the ammunition and the evidence. But these are the same people, unfortunately, that if the officers had gone into the apartment, they would have done so illegally. Suppose, mm-hmm. let's just change the scenario just a touch, because this is a very real possibility of what could have taken place. Suppose the officers had gone into the apartment because they had a gut feeling or because they just believed that this guy, you know, there was more to this. So they entered the apartment. It would have been illegal to do so. Now, suppose mm-hmm. that this Elliot had been armed and had decided, okay, you know what, I have to now hasten my plans and I'm going to take out these cops. Had mm-hmm. drawn one of his firearms or gone after a firearm, and the officers had killed him, which is what would have taken place.
Right.
Then there would have been a huge outcry that the police used excessive force, made an illegal entry, and killed the son of a Hollywood producer, director, whatever he is. And there would have been a huge outcry as to how the cops violated his civil rights.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what
true.
Would take
I
place
can see that.
If, or what could have taken place easily if the officers had followed a different route. So the officers who responded to this did what they were legally responsible to do. And if mm-hmm. they had done otherwise, then they would have put their careers on the line, faced criminal charges, and it could have gone into an entirely different direction. Now, in hindsight, trust me when I could tell you this from 34 years of police experience, I wish I had done several things differently during my career where I should have gone an extra mile, violated somebody's rights, and I would have saved somebody's life. And that's the reality.
Right.
Right. You know, we are legally restrained, and for legitimate reasons, you know, we can't go into people's homes, especially mm-hmm. people's homes. When you're looking at a search to seizure kind of incident.
In a situation like this, Randy, it's the cops, they can't win. You know, they didn't go in, but if they would have gone in, they may not have even stopped it then. And then his rights would have been violated, and all kinds of hullabaloo would have happened, and it would have just been a mess. So I wish people could see that. They just had no legal right to go in, and they have to follow the law. Now, of course, like, you know, you're talking, if they could see in the future that by violating his rights they would save all these lives, I'm sure they would have, but they would have no idea. They just wouldn't, and people need to lay off. Now, Randy, I want to talk to you a little bit about the police in general, because it seems to me lately that there just seems to be a lot of police killing a lot of people. Are you getting that, or is it just, am I just being overdramatic here? It just seems like they're just shooting more.
There have been some pretty high-profile incidents lately that have really come under the spotlight. And some of these incidents have been pretty improper shooting incidents. I mean, the reality is this.
Mm-hmm.
Use of force, deadly use of force incidents by police can happen anytime, any place, in small towns, in big cities. They happen in an instant. And you have to be prepared mentally, physically, emotionally. You have to be trained to respond properly. And there's a lot to this subject that you're talking about. But I'm gonna I have a pretty good handle on it because of 34 years of police experience, and I also
right.
actually speak to police officers all over the country on the topic called Policing with Honor, which is a seminar that I put together that creates the environment where police officers can learn about surviving their career ethically as well as physically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a police officer has to survive, not just physically, but emotionally and ethically. And those are
emotionally
those are,
especially, yeah.
And when you combine those three, it's a really tough. It's a tough thing to do when, you know, a police career lasts 25, 30 years, and there is a lot of there's a lot to that career where you can fall prey to temptation, you can fall prey to your ego, you can fall prey to in a lot of different ways, as well as not surviving physically because you didn't act with a true police survival mentality. So there's a lot to this, much more than most people realize. So your question was about some recent incidents that have taken place, very high-profile incidents, where the police have been accused of excessive force or not acting properly. And in point of fact, there have been several incidents where, after I have reviewed some of the videotape, that, you know, I have to say the reality is that sometimes we screw up. And
but it just seems like it's getting worse, though. Don't you think?
I don't know that it's getting worse. I would have to say probably not. That that just because there are some, you know, there's a lot more videotaped evidence of it that makes
That's
it
true.
Appear
That's
to be
true.
More. So
right.
I don't know that it really has changed. I would have to say actually it's probably, there's probably less questionable use of force than there was in the past, because police officers are so much more aware and better trained than they have been in the past. But
you talked.
You know,
go ahead.
When a police use of force incident takes place, and the police respond improperly and use force where they kill a guy and it's captured on videotape, and there truly is a question about their tactics and about the reasons behind it, it is very, very damning for the entire law enforcement environment.
Absolutely. It really is. And you mentioned early when in the interview here, we're talking with Randy L. Sutton. Randy is a former lieutenant with the Las Vegas Police Department, many years in law enforcement, and now retired but doing some incredible things. We'll be getting to those in just a moment. At the beginning of the show, you mentioned that you were 18 when you were a police officer in New Jersey. 19.
Right.
And your mom had to buy your bullets because you couldn't buy bullets until you were 21.
True story.
Don't you think, I know, I love it. Don't you think that making kids that young, giving kids at that age, the responsibility of being a police officer, because now I think it's 19 in some places, if I'm not mistaken, or is it 21? Even 21, you know, it just seems like that's so young. Because you're thrown into sometimes the dregs of society, and you're put into horrible, scary situations, and you're so young, you haven't learned about life yet. Do you think that might be part of the problem?
Well, if you are a student of history as I am, you go back to the Greatest Generation when 16 and 17-year-olds entered the United States Army and Marines and Navy in World War II, and they were thrust into incredible situations that so many rose to that occasion. It's a time to grow up fast. And if you make the determination and decision that you want to serve your community, that call to service can come very, very early. And I look upon my personal view of my career was I look back on some of the decisions that I made when I was 19 as a police officer, and I shudder to tell you the truth.
Because
there's a maturity level that has to take place in order to be effective as a police officer. But at the same time, becoming a police officer matures you in a way that nothing else can, because you are thrust into life and you're thrust into a role where you sink, swim, you can touch the lives of others in ways that you could never before do. So there are challenges, but at the same time, there are rewards.
Right. That's the truth, and you're right. You're put in a situation like that, and you grow up very fast. What type of mental health screening do they do with police officers?
Well, to become a police officer in the United States today is actually more difficult than becoming a doctor. If you look at the statistics, 100 out of 5,000 applicants will ever make it into the police field. So it's very, very...
Wow.
There's very, very stringent hiring requirements because... Let me run you through the process. I decided I want to be a cop. I'm 21 years old, and this is what I want to do with my life. I go to the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department and say, I want to become a police officer. Okay? Well, when there is an opening, you will be given a series of tests which will determine whether or not they will hire you. And this is pretty much the same all over the United States. I make a decision I want to become a cop. I make an application to a police department. When that application process takes place, there will be, for one opening, there will be hundreds, perhaps even thousands of applicants. In order to be chosen to that position, I'm going to have to take a written examination to determine my intelligence, my writing abilities, the written test is your educational experience, and if I pass that, and many people will not pass that, if I pass that, then I have to go on to a physical examination to determine my physical fitness level. Now, this is something that's been very interesting over the years, because the physical fitness level of the American man and woman has diminished demonstrably in the last 10 or 20 years because of obesity, because of lack of health. So now I'm going to have to do 50 push-ups and 50 sit-ups or whatever the physical fitness exam is. That's going to knock out another third of the people. If I pass that, then I'm going to have to pass an oral board where I'm going to be called in and I'm going to have three or four officers in front of me, and I'm going to have to answer questions about how I would handle situations, and they're going to evaluate me on the way that I present myself, on the way that I look, on the way that I think, and that's going to knock out another third of the people.
Oh, my gosh.
Once you get past that, then you have to take a psychological exam, which is going to knock out a whole bunch more folks.
A lot more now, people, right.
But, and then there's even a bigger issue. I'm going to have to pass either a polygraph or a background investigation to determine if there's anything in my past that I have done that would preclude me from being a cop. Did I steal? Did I lie? Did I do drugs, certain drugs? And that knocks out another huge percentage of people.
Mm-hmm.
So when you whittle it all down, out of 5,000 people, you're lucky to get 100 qualified applicants.
That is amazing. I'm glad to hear it, though. I'm glad to hear it is that tough to become a cop, because that's what we want. We want to weed everybody out that isn't absolutely right for this job. Is it hard to fire? Oh, I want to. Here's what. Let me back up. Let me reel that back in and start over. Have you ever heard the term badge heavy?
Yes.
Well,
I
found that out.
I have been badge heavy.
Have you? Well, here's how I know that term, what I know that term to mean. That a cop just likes kind of pushing people around and just being really difficult and pulling you over for every little thing and getting on your case constantly. And, you know, and I was telling my cop friend about this cop. I live in a small town who was doing this. And he said, well, that guy's cop heavy, and they probably just can't fire him because he hasn't really done anything wrong, even though everybody in the community hates him because all he does is harass people for nothing, for absolutely nothing. And is that what it means? And what is it?
That is what it means. The term badge heavy, there's a lot of different terms for it. In essence, what it is, it's a lack of maturity and understanding about what the principles of police power are. And keep in mind that when you become a police officer, many people do it at a young age. Like I was 19, you know, the age now is 21, and you know, people get hired at relatively young ages where they haven't actually matured as much as they could have. Now, every person in their life has an evolution. I'm not the same person that I was when I was 21. And I view the world differently now than I did when I was 21. And at the same time, a police officer's career also evolves. And, you know, the way you view policing at the early stages of your career changes over time. You come to understand the human experience a little more. You come to be a little more understanding of people's issues. And if there was a way to inject in our police officers the true compassion and empathy that is required at the outset of a career, that would be a wonderful thing. But most of us, because we are human, have to learn it, have to gain that experience through, you know, through watching and learning, just like any other career. So there are people that, now, I'm not going to tell you that there are not police officers out there who are drunk with power, because it does happen. And unfortunately, when one person has a decent citizen has a interaction with a police officer who is badge heavy, who is not who doesn't understand the principles of police power and abuses that power, it can really truly create dissension within the community. It can, you know, one of the things that I talk about when I do my policing with honor seminar is I talk about how a police officer is always on stage. Every stage of our career, when we are in uniform, is being viewed by members of the public. And it has the ability to touch people's lives in very, very meaningful ways, either in a positive way or a negative way. So if I decide to give somebody a ticket because they were going 2 miles an hour over the limit because the police department has given me a quota, what I have done is now taken an individual, written them a citation, which is going to cost them money, and is going to create in their world the thoughts that the police are overbearing and are and have crossed the line, and in effect, it's true. Was there, you know, is there a technical violation? Okay, maybe there is, but the good citizen deserves a break, and this is something that is difficult to explain to officers sometimes when they're in the early stages of their career, because things are very, very black and white. Yeah. And that's where good leadership, that's where compassionate leadership really enters the situation. And there are, trust me when I tell you this, I've seen a lot of bad Chevy cops. As I said, during my career, I look back on some of the decisions that I made, and I was one of those people at certain times. The reality is that there are about 1 million police officers in this country, and most of them, the vast majority, are very, very dedicated to what they do, and they are they are people that believe in the mission of law enforcement. Mm-hmm. And they are out there every day trying to accomplish that mission in the best way that they can. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't going to be abuses. That doesn't mean that there aren't going to be uses of force that are way over the bounds of responsibility, and they will happen. But they have to be dealt with and for the most part, most of the men and women that are out there every day are really doing their best.
You have said it all. That is absolutely correct. And, you know, I'm trying to always be on the side of a cop, but I'll tell you what, sometimes there are two sides of the story. And like you said, it could be a young officer just kind of learning the way. And in the beginning, everything is black and white. And as they get older, they realize things are a bit more gray. So I'm glad to hear that you do talk to officers all over the country about being a good cop, because that's important. It's important to have to bring people back to the center and you know, remind them of what they're doing. We're talking with Randy Sutton. Randy has done everything, basically. He was a lieutenant with the police department in Vegas. He has since become an author, an actor, and a writer. And we were starting to talk about, I believe, your writing before we kind of change subjects to talk about the shooting. What were we talking about? You started talking about how that you had turned in your career into a writer, right?
Mm-hmm. Well,
and
I
then you started talking, and I interrupted you.
Well, I think I'm going to tell you the story of how my police career ended, because it's kind of germane to the things that we're talking about. I had a wonderful career. My career was 34 years, 10 with the Princeton, New Jersey Police, and then 24. Mm-hmm. with the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police, where I rose to the rank of lieutenant. And the last call of my career, I was the watch commander. And I had already written 3 books. My first book was called True Blue, Police Stories by Those Who Have Lived Them. And I wrote this book. I collected stories from cops from all over the nation after the World Trade Center was attacked. And that was the deadliest day in law enforcement history. 72 police officers were killed.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to do something that would aid the families of those police officers, but at the same time, create a bridge between law enforcement officers and the people that we serve, because there truly is a misunderstanding on a lot of different levels. So I had written a story. I didn't consider myself, I never viewed that I would have a writing career, if you will, but I had written a story about saving the life of a one-month-old girl who was shot in the face in a drive-by shooting. And it was an incident that happened to me when I was a police sergeant. The incident occurred one night. I was on patrol, and I saw a car up on the sidewalk and people running around screaming. I had no idea what had taken place. I got out of my car to investigate, and I heard, "Oh, my God, the baby's been shot." And I looked down, and there was a one-month-old who was in a baby seat, and she had been shot in the face.
Oh, my God.
What had taken place was two or three gang members on a gang initiation pulled up to this family at a traffic light and just opened fire on the car. One of the bullets struck the baby in the face.
Mm-hmm.
And by whatever providence there is, I appeared on the scene quite literally within a minute of the shooting taking place. Mm-hmm. The baby was critically injured and stopped breathing. I could not wait for an ambulance to get there because she would have died. So I grabbed the first patrol car that got there, and I said, "Let's get to the hospital right now." We radioed that we were bringing in a baby who wasn't breathing. And I was able to clear her airway and give her mouth-to-mouth resuscitation and bring her back. And when we got to the hospital, mm-hmm. handed her off to the trauma surgeons, who did a remarkable job in bringing her, stabilizing her and getting her surgery. Well, that little girl changed my life. Because being a part of saving the life of an infant really moved me in a way that I never had anticipated. And I had to write that story.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. I wrote that story and stuck it in a drawer because I had no idea what to do with it, but I knew that I needed to write it. Not long after, several years, is when the World Trade Center attack happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that my mission was to do something to help those families of the officers who were killed. And I asked other police officers from around the country to give me their stories that about something that touched them. And what came out of that was an incredible book called True Blue Police Stories by Those Who Have Lived Them. And it was published by St. Martin's Press in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And all the royalties went to the widows and orphans of the police officers who were killed in 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that began my writing career. And St. Martin's Press asked me to write a book of all my own stories, which was my second book. It's called The Cop's Life.
Mm-hmm.
Which is available on Amazon, also on my website, thelegacychallenge.com. And then the third book, which I also donated royalties to the Police Officers Memorial Fund for those who were killed in the line of duty, was True Blue to Protect and Serve.
Mm-hmm.
So those were all police-related books, and they all did quite well. They're still in publication, and people can buy them. But when I, towards the end of my career, I suffered a stroke in my police car.
Oh, dear.
And was...
You're so young.
Well, there was a number of things that had taken place. Within a very short period, my mother, with whom I lived, after my dad died, I brought her out to Vegas to come live with me. And we had 5 great years. And then she became terminally ill. And she went into home hospice care. Mm-hmm. And, you know, watching your mother go through that pain and that trauma is really devastating.
It is.
And
I'm so sorry.
She was going through that, and she kind of stabilized enough for me to go back to work. I took leave from the police department to stay with her. And after a couple of months, she rather stabilized, and I went back to work. And 2 weeks after I got back to work, I was involved in my 5th officer-involved shooting incident where a guy was trying to kill his wife and baby. And I was forced to, I was the watch commander, give the order to fire, and I also was involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
And when you when you're involved in a use of force incident, as we were talking about earlier, and you take the life of another human being, I can assure you that you don't walk out of that unscathed. You know, the
No matter what the situation.
Exactly. And television and movies, they glamorize these incidents, and mm-hmm. They make it appear that this is the normal course of business for police, when actually less than 1% of police officers throughout their entire career will actually even fire their weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do, I can assure you that you don't walk out of there the same person that you were before you walked in.
Right.
So that took place, and then my mother died shortly thereafter. And 3 weeks later, I suffered a stroke in my police car.
Yeah, that is stress-related.
Yeah, I would have to say.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was some stress involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
And when I did that, I was on patrol, and I had a young police officer with me because I was the watch commander, and I always took a young cop with me so they could see their watch commander actually did some police work every now and then. And
mm-hmm.
and this young man is with me, and I 2:30 in the morning in front of Bally's Hotel, and I felt the stroke coming on. And I told him, I stopped the police car, and I said, "You got to get me medical help because I'm having a stroke." Mm-hmm. And this poor kid looks at me, and he was wondering, "Is my lieutenant screwing with me?"
Is he just teasing me? Right.
Yeah, did he? Right. And he realizes that this was the real deal. And I got out of the police car, went around to the passenger side, and went down on the ground, was unable to speak, was unable to move. And of all the things that I have experienced in 34 years as a cop, nothing was more frightening than that.
Oh, I can imagine.
And I was very, very fortunate that I got to the hospital. And no disability because of it, as mm-hmm. far as, you know, the ability to move or talk, or, you know, I got all that back. But they also gave me a diagnosis that was life-threatening. They told me that what caused the stroke was a disease that I am now living with. And I understand mm-hmm. that my time here may be limited. And at first I was devastated by that news. And at the second mm-hmm. look at it, I realized what a great gift I was given. I call mm-hmm. it the gift of clarity, because I was given the ability to see what my future was and understand that I haven't stopped being able to serve simply because of a medical diagnosis. And
very good.
The way that I view this is, after 34 years of all the negativity, of all of the violence and the watching what people are capable of doing to one another, there's another side of that page.
Mm-hmm.
And that is all the great people that are doing wonderful things.
Well, that's
for
true.
Each other.
Right.
And so what I did for the, have done for the last year, and this is truly one of the most wonderful experiences I've had, is I traveled the country talking to people that have done amazing things with their lives for others.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, the man who created the Make-A-Wish Foundation.
Right.
His name is Frank Shankwitz, and you might not mm-hmm. know his name, but you certainly know what he accomplished with creating the Make-A-Wish Foundation.
It's amazing.
And he,
yes,
was
it is.
He was an Arizona highway patrolman.
Oh,
when
wow.
When he started it. Then he was exposed to a young boy, 7 years old, who was dying of leukemia.
Mm-hmm.
And he granted his last wish by indoctrinating him into the Arizona Highway Patrol as a 7-year-old.
Oh.
His story is absolutely amazing. I took his story and, leading off the book with it, interviewed 26 people who
mm-hmm.
have done similar things with their lives. Not about who they are and what they have accomplished, but who their personal heroes were. The people
right.
in their lives that inspired them to give back and to do things in ways that touch the lives of other people. So this book is called The Power of Legacy,
mm-hmm.
Personal Heroes of America's Most Inspiring People. And I can tell you that anyone that reads this book will not walk away without having a few tears, but at the same time feeling that there is great strength in humanity and wonderful people that are part of this life.
And that's, you know, I think that's what we need to hear, because of all the negativity out there. It's good to have all these good stories in one place. And that's great that you're going to share them with us, because we need to hear about the good in people, because we certainly hear about the bad. That never ends. Now, you have a website. We're talking with Randy Sutton, former Las Vegas lieutenant with the Las Vegas Police Department. And your website is called LegacyChallenge.com. Tell us about that.
Well, you're close. It's www.thelegacychallenge.com.
Yeah,
and
there we go.
It's my website that talks about my books, talks about my philosophies of personal kindness and personal heroes. You know, every mm-hmm. one of us has the ability to be the personal hero to another human being. And
that's true.
It doesn't have to be in these very dramatic ways that I've talked about in my book. You know, people that have created these amazing organizations, because simply by touching the life of another person in great mm-hmm. or small ways, you can become the personal hero to that person. And this is taking place every day in every little town, in every city, but we rarely hear about it. And what I'm trying to accomplish with my book and with this website is to advocate being a personal hero, to
mm-hmm.
reach out to other people and touch them with acts of kindness, with empathy, with compassion. And by doing that, we create a better world, a world that, as a police officer, I the reason I loved being a cop for all those years was because I could play a role
mm-hmm.
in the lives of others in a positive way. But we can all do that in very, very many ways. And that's what my books and my website are all about.
And you don't need to be a police officer to affect other people in their lives. You can, just you alone can really make a difference in not just one person's life, in a lot of people's lives, by doing simple, kind things. And I think that message gets lost a bit, Randy, that it doesn't take a whole, like you said, it doesn't need to be a big, dramatic, you know, life-saving thing to help somebody change their life or to help them along with the trials and tribulations that they're going through. It's all about human kindness. And I think that's wonderful what you're doing. I think that's absolutely wonderful. Now, so you have this going on. Is there anything, that's not enough. Is there anything else going on that we missed? I want to make sure that we've covered everything there is about Randy Sutton today.
Well, as a matter of fact, there's something even bigger.
Oh, I want to hear it.
Well, you know, I told you a little bit about what happened, you know, at the end of my career when I suffered the stroke and was given the diagnosis. And, you know, my parents were both heroes. My dad was a World War II vet. And when I lost him, as well as when I lost my mom, it fell to me to pick up their address books and start making phone calls to their friends and telling them that they had passed on. And that was a very, very, very painful thing to do.
Right.
And I wanted to be able to honor my parents in a way that was everlasting. And at the same time, while I was going through trying to understand my medical diagnosis and the understanding that my time might be limited, I wanted to view my legacy in a way that I never had before. How would I be remembered, and how could I remember those that I loved? And I've been working since that to create something that is going to be launched probably in August now. I spent actually every penny of my retirement into creating something called Celebrating Legacy.
Mm-hmm.
And Celebrating Legacy, I believe, is going to change the lives of millions of people worldwide, because what we have created is a technology that allows me to honor the lives of the people that I love permanently, at the same time, create my own personal legacy in written, audio, and digital form to pass on to future generations, so that the lessons that I learned in life, the philosophy that I believe in, will not die with me. But
okay,
be...
Randy, I'm confused. What exactly is it? Is it something for a tombstone? Is it something that you get after you die that you've prepared, or what is it?
No, it's a web-based service that allows people to create their personal legacies to pass on
to future
generations.
Okay. Right, that's a great idea.
It's I can tell you this, Tricia, it's going to be life changing for millions of people. We have created technology that is going to be life changing, because it's going to allow people the comfort to know how they will be remembered. You know, one of the things that I think that we are all concerned with is, at the end of my life, how will people view me? How will my memory? How will my memory touch other people?
Mm-hmm.
And so what we have created is the ability for me to leave my personal legacy of thought, my writings, my artwork, my music, whatever it is in my life that I found important, you'll be able to go on 20 years from now and see who I am. So your
family—that
is
a great idea.
It's something I'm. Of all the things that I've done, I believe this will touch more people than anything that I have ever done, including my books.
Is it available now?
No, it's not. Although people can actually go on to celebratinglegacy.com, and if your listeners would like to sign up to be an alpha tester, they can do that.
Oh, I bet they'd love that.
And I would love them to do it, because
what's that address again?
www.celebratinglegacy.com. www.thefilmmaker.com.
Okay. I'm just typing it in here for our chat room.
Celebratinglegacy.com.
Okay?
Right.
And so that way they can go on and be
beta. We're going to start testing this in probably July or August. And we would love to get the feedback from the people that we've got thousands of people signed up to do it. Because this really touches the very nature of human existence, because all of us are concerned with our legacy.
Oh, absolutely.
And, bringing families closer through the sharing of memories and having that permanently archived family history from your own lips is something that has never been created before. That's what we're doing.
Boy, you do a lot. I mean, you get a lot done in a day, that's for sure. And if you go to the other website, www.thelegacychallenge.com, you can also contact Randy there. There's a place on that website if you would like to talk to him about anything. I'm sure you're open to hearing from people who enjoy your books and who enjoy your scenes in movies. We certainly do love them, that's for sure. Randy, thank you so much. I hope you will continue to stay in touch with us and let us know how things are going, and think of some more good Hollywood juicy stories, because we love them all right here.
I do have a couple others, and next time we'll talk about them.
Wonderful. I told you it'd be 45 minutes. It's more like an hour and a half. So sorry. It was just a lot of, it was close enough. It was a lot of interesting stuff. So thank you, Randy L. Sutton, former lieutenant with the Las Vegas Police Department. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. We'll talk again soon, okay?
Thank you. Appreciate it, Tricia. Good night.
Take care. Bye-bye. You know, there are people like Randy Sutton who just do things, get up in the morning and accomplish more in a day than I would probably accomplish in a year. That really is an amazing guy. Very interesting guest. And you know what? That does it for the show, everybody. Yeah, we're done. It's over. Other than this, it's brought to you by, that's Trisha's True Crime Radio, that is brought to you by the Doris Day Animal Foundation, www.dorisdayanimalfoundation.com. Doris Day started it herself. She was sick and tired of seeing homeless animals in Southern California, and so she did something about it. Just go take a look at her website. It's fascinating. www.dorisdayanimalfoundation.com. That's it, everybody. We'll see you next week for Trisha's True Crime Radio, where we discuss true crime and current events. And you know, we always do it with common sense. Good night, everyone.